Today is Wednesday, the 1st of September, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden defends his decision to leave Afghanistan once again.
It was time to be honest with the American people again. We no longer had a clear purpose in an open-ended mission in Afghanistan.
As Republicans continue to hammer the administration's handling of the events.
This notion that the war is over is garbage.
And Haitian President Jovenel Moïse's widow makes a plea to bring his killers to justice. These stories and more next. U.S. President Joe Biden defended his decision to end the country's two-decade war in Afghanistan in an impassioned speech Tuesday. He said the success of America's largest airlift was due to the incredible skill, bravery, and selfless courage of the United States military and its diplomats, as well as its intelligence professionals.
In April, I made a decision to end this war. As part of that decision, we set the date of August 31st for American troops to withdraw. The assumption was that more than 300,000 Afghan national security forces that we had trained over the past two decades and equipped would be a strong adversary in their civil wars with the Taliban. That assumption that the Afghan government would be able to hold on for a period of time beyond military drawdown turned out not to be accurate.
Biden reiterated that the Taliban have made public commitments promising safe passage for anyone wanting to leave, including those who worked alongside Americans.
In fact, just yesterday, the United Nations Security Council passed a resolution that sent a clear message about the international community expects the Taliban to deliver on moving forward, notably freedom of travel, freedom to leave. And together, we are joined by over 100 countries that are determined to make sure the Taliban upholds those commitments.
The president revisited his decision-making process, noting that the previous Trump administration had struck a deal with the Taliban for all U.S. forces to leave the country by May 1st of this year.
By the time I came to office, the Taliban was in its strongest military position since 2001. Controlling or contesting nearly half of the country.
Biden said that while he was the fourth president faced with the question of whether or not to end the deployment in Afghanistan or continue it, he reminded those watching the address that he ran on the promise of ending America's longest war and not passing it on to a successor.
It was time to be honest with the American people again. We no longer had a clear purpose in an open-ended mission in Afghanistan. After 20 years of war in Afghanistan, I refuse to send another generation of America's sons and daughters to fight a war that should have ended long ago.
President Biden said that it was time to focus on things that were in the country's national interest.
We're engaged in a serious competition with China. We're dealing with the challenges on multiple fronts with Russia. We're confronted with cyber attacks and nuclear proliferation. We have to shore up America's competitiveness to meet these new challenges in the competition for the 21st century.
And when it came to addressing the threat of terror groups, Biden said the U.S. would take on those challenges here and now, as well as in the future.
To those who wish America harm, to those who engage in terrorism against us or our allies, know this. The United States will never rest. We will not forgive. We will not forget. We'll hunt you down to the ends of the earth, and you will pay the ultimate price.
Earlier, Republicans continued to criticize President Biden and his administration over the Afghan pullout. Associated Press Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has that part of our coverage.
How did this get so wrong?
Texas Congressman Michael McCaul is among those calling it shameful, a disaster, a bungled operation.
So what is today about? It's about fixing this.
Fellow Texan Dan Crenshaw, a Navy SEAL wounded in Afghanistan, says first the administration needs to admit it screwed up and, for starters, make concrete plans to evacuate all remaining Americans from Afghanistan. And then there's the longer-term picture of terrorism. Florida's Michael Michael Waltz, another Afghan vet, says al-Qaeda is now primed to regroup and attack the West again. The administration needs to be ready.
This notion that the war is over is garbage.
Sagar Meghani at the White House.
Deportation centers in Turkey are filled to capacity as refugees from Afghanistan continue to cross the border from Iran by night, hoping to evade police and resettle. As VOA tours a deportation center in Van, officials say that they're not sending people back to Afghanistan, but they also have no plans to release detainees. VOA's Heather Murdoch has this story.
Refugees from Afghanistan say crossing this border from Iran to Turkey is a chance at freedom and safety after weeks or months of grueling travel from Afghanistan. But once they get across, many go into hiding, hoping to evade police and deportation. Those who are caught are often held in deportation camps. Many are children.
I was running from police, and I fell in a deep ditch and broke my leg.
Turkish authorities take us on a tour of a deportation camp not far from the border. They say their goal is to prevent more refugees from entering Turkey to seek asylum, but they also want us to witness what appears to be generally humane treatment.
There are 126 rooms in this facility, all meeting international quality standards.
Officials say 80% of the people detained in this facility are from Afghanistan, and they cannot be deported to their home country for logistical and humanitarian reasons. Earlier this month, the Taliban swept into Kabul after taking over vast swaths of Afghanistan in a matter of days. Since then, mass evacuations have left the Kabul airport in chaos, and Islamic State suicide bombers have killed at least 170 Afghan people and 13 U.S. service members. Now the country is on edge, waiting to find out what happens after the U.S. met its avowed August 31st deadline to pull out of Afghanistan completely. Officials say maybe next week or next month they can formulate a plan beyond resettling refugees in a third country, which is often impossible. Families say despite their uncertain future in Turkey or beyond, they had no choice but to leave.
It was war. Everything was deteriorating. We had to go.
Turkey hosts more than 4 million refugees and asylum seekers, more than any other country in the world. Many Turkish people say the refugee population is a strain on their economy. Soldiers say they are working hard to keep the refugees out. The government says it is not forcing people back across this border to Iran. But many refugees say they have entered Turkey and been forced back out many times. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Van and the Turkish border with Iran.
As the U.S. ends its presence in Afghanistan, the United Nations reiterates its pledge to remain in the country, dispensing aid to those who need it. The UN Refugee Agency is also appealing to countries to keep their borders open to Afghan refugees and asylum seekers. The World Health Organization says that it's planning several more urgent shipments of medical supplies in the coming days into Afghanistan through the Mazar-e-Sharif airport, as the Kabul airport isn't an option. Lisa Schlein is up next.
The Taliban now is in charge of the country, but there is no centralized government in place. UN agencies say that is problematic. However, they note they've been talking with the Taliban and other groups for decades about accessing people in need. Spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Laerke, says he believes that experience will allow aid agencies to gain the necessary acceptance to carry out their life-saving operations.
The armies have left, but the UN is staying, and we are committed to stay. And that's what we have said from the beginning, and that's what we are doing. Just to remind you that we have already delivered humanitarian aid to some 8 million people this year alone. So I think that is simply a number that demonstrates that we are there to stay.
The United Nations aims to assist 16 million people this year, including 3.5 million people forcibly uprooted from their homes by conflict. However, it acknowledges that may not be possible, as it has received only 39% of the $1.3 billion humanitarian appeal. The World Health Organization succeeded in flying in 12.5 tons of medical supplies into the Mazar-e-Sharif airport in Afghanistan Monday. WHO spokeswoman Margaret Harris says much more is needed. She says the WHO is planning two further airlifts this week from the WHO's logistics hub in Dubai and is exploring other options to get more shipments into the country. She says the WHO is concerned that many non-governmental organizations are forced to scale down operations and close health facilities for lack of money. That, she says, is depriving millions of Afghans of necessary primary and secondary health care.
The range of services that will be impacted include immunization for children, antenatal care, postnatal care, and child delivery for pregnant women, malnutrition care, and COVID treatment centres and other essential health services will also be affected. It's estimated that the closure of every 50 health facilities could lead to the death of 5 more women and 58 more children under 5 years of age every day.
Aid agencies say they fear the tragedy that has been unfolding in Afghanistan will no longer be visible now that the airlifts out of Kabul have ended. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi warns a far greater humanitarian crisis is just beginning. He is urging nations to keep their borders open to Afghans fleeing persecution and conflict and who need international protection. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The latest sign of the economic collapse afflicting Lebanon is a fuel crisis that's paralyzed the country. Now, the militant group Hezbollah says it will import fuel from Iran, a move that could bring more trouble than it relieves. Jacob Russell takes it from here.
In recent weeks, a fuel shortage has gripped Lebanon, creating chaos on the roads and adding to a feeling of powerlessness.
Well, we can't do anything at the moment. Just wait.
Something is wrong with this country. Those in power are laughing at us.
Fuel oil for the generators that now supply most of Lebanon's electricity has also been in short supply, plunging the country into darkness. Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, recently announced that the party would be importing shipments of oil from Iran to try and ease the shortage.
After the first vessel arrives, another vessel will follow suit, followed by another, and then several more. This is not about one ship only.
For those sympathetic to the Iranian-backed militant group, Hezbollah is simply trying to provide solutions to an ongoing problem.
If there is enough oil, Iran will stop sending. The ships do not come. This has nothing to do with influence in the area.
Although designated as a terrorist organization by much of the West, Hezbollah is a major political and social force in Lebanon. In Lebanon's worsening crisis, analysts say the party stands to gain if people see it as resolving problems that the state is not fixing.
They're saying that we are an alternative to the state. The state has failed in resolving the fuel crisis, and we can bring fuel from Iran and distribute it across the country.
Hezbollah blames Lebanon's crisis on U.S. sanctions. Critics warn that by violating sanctions on Iran, Hezbollah risks bringing further punishment down on Lebanon, or even military action against the ships themselves. But analysts say that if this were to happen, it would not necessarily be a blow to Hezbollah and the image it wants to create.
If they're stopped, and if there's any hurdle or obstacles along the way, they would just point fingers and say, this is the United States not only causing this shipment from not being distributed, but being responsible for all of Lebanon's pains in the past 2 years. So it's really a win-win scenario for the organization.
For Hezbollah, the fuel crisis presents an opportunity to reaffirm a narrative of resistance against outside forces. While fuel shortages may be alleviated in the short term, some see Hezbollah's and Iran's intercession as a gamble in which Lebanese future relations with the West could be at stake. Jacob Russell, VOA News, Beirut.
Iran's new top diplomat appears to be focusing his efforts on Arab states in a bid to achieve a thaw in the long-frozen relations with Tehran's Arab and Gulf neighbors. The effort comes amid the ongoing proxy war in Yemen that involves Iran and Saudi Arabia. Edward Uranian has more.
Iran's regional proxies turned up the heat on nemesis Saudi Arabia this week, striking Saudi-controlled Anad airbase near Aden, Yemen on Sunday and Abha airport on Saudi soil in a drone bomb attack early Tuesday. Reports say 8 people were injured in Tuesday's attack, which the Saudis blamed on Iran-backed Houthi rebels. There was no immediate comment from the rebels. The incidents follow overtures by Iranian Foreign Minister Hussein Amir Abdullahian towards Arab adversaries at a recent regional summit in Baghdad. Abdullahian's first appearance at the top diplomatic gathering since assuming the post of foreign minister last week was marked by an appeal for regional cooperation. Some Arab leaders appeared to resent Abdullahian's presence, along with his attempt to win over his audience by speaking Arabic. Abdullahian's Iraqi hosts were openly seeking a diplomatic breakthrough by prompting a thaw in relations between Tehran and its top regional adversaries, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Abdullahian also blamed outside players for regional tensions, apparently alluding to the United States and its allies. Abdullahian says that Iran continues to insist on achieving peace based on dialogue and regional efforts, and that Iran hopes these countries come to the realization that the only way to do that is through mutual confidence of the countries in the region based on strengthening dialogue and avoiding outside interference. It was not clear if Abdullahian succeeded in changing long-standing positions of Saudi Arabia and the UAE. A Sunday visit to Syria's capital, Damascus, appeared unlikely to soften regional ill feelings over Iran's domination of Arab states like Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Yemen. The attacks on Anad airbase and on Abha airport also seemed unlikely to improve ties with Riyadh. Iranian analyst and former diplomat Mirdad Kansari tells VOA that Saudi Arabia is being forced to soften its position toward Iran, despite the fact that it dislikes the Islamic Republic.
Yemen has been a total disaster for them, and they know that they can't get out of Yemen without Iranian assistance and without some sort of Iranian pull to the kind of support that they're providing the Houthis. And at the same time, they don't like having to do what they're having to do. So they are doing something where they're having to walk a line which they absolutely detest, and it's been essentially forced upon them.
Washington-based Gulf analyst Theodore Karasik tells VOA that he thinks the new Iranian foreign minister is quickly showing what he is made of. Karasik noted that Abdullahian paid his respects to his former mentor, the late General Qasem Soleimani, by praying at the spot outside Baghdad's airport where a U.S. drone strike killed Soleimani in January of last year. Soleimani was the head of Iran's elite Quds force. Karasik also points out that Abdullahian seemingly broke protocol at the Baghdad summit by not being in his assigned photo spot before going to Damascus Sunday for a very warm meeting with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Karasik said the moves are being interpreted by some Middle East analysts as being aggressive and perhaps are setting the tone as Iran's new president, Ibrahim Raisi, sets up his team. During his visit to Damascus, Abdullahian took time for photos with President Assad and gave a short press conference at the Syrian Foreign Ministry, indicating that Tehran and Damascus are the warmest of allies. Both Abdullahian and Iran's national security advisor, Admiral Ali Shamkhani, had close ties to Soleimani, so the new government appears to be asserting that there will be no change from Soleimani's regional strategies. Given Abdullahian's aggressive behavior, notes Karasik, Western interlocutors are in for a very interesting time as Iran's nuclear file gets a fresh look by Tehran's new team. Iran has maintained that its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The International Committee of the Red Cross says that more than 48,000 people are missing across Africa and at least 21,600 are minors. Most of the registered disappearances, widely believed to be a fraction of the continent's wider undocumented humanitarian tragedy, are linked to armed conflict, violence, disaster, and migration across the continent. The ICRC says that the majority of those missing are from seven countries with armed conflicts. Nigerian health officials say that nearly 1,800 people have died of cholera this year, with cases found in more than 20 states around the country. To combat the bacterial disease that is spread by dirty water, Nigeria's Federal Ministry of Environment is urging proper hygiene and organizing mass cleanups in affected areas. Diarrhea is a common symptom when a person contracts cholera, which is a bacterial disease that causes dehydration. The Polish government has asked President Andrzej Duda to declare a state of emergency along the Poland-Belarus border. Poland accuses Belarus of using migrants as political pawns by pushing them into the European Union in retaliation over EU sanctions. According to a recent BBC report, Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko accused Poland of starting a border conflict and violating his country's territory. Communities in the southern U.S. states of Louisiana and Mississippi are cleaning up and assessing the damage as the remnants of what was Hurricane Ida moves out of the region. Officials say that the storm is responsible for the deaths of at least four people. Meanwhile, more than 1 million people remain without power in Louisiana. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The widow of Haiti's slain president, Jovenel Moise, is calling on the international community to help track down those responsible for assassinating her husband. Reuters' Flora Bradley Watson brings us that story.
I won't stop asking for justice until justice is found.
In an interview with Reuters, Martine Moise said she was determined to get justice for her husband, who was gunned down in a late-night raid by suspected mercenaries at the couple's home in July. Moise's murder plunged the Caribbean nation, already plagued by hunger and gang violence, further into chaos and triggered a hunt for the masterminds across the Americas.
Every country that can help, please help, because the people that did that are still out there. And I don't know if their name will ever be out.
Nearly 2 months on from the assassination, certain aspects of the murder remains shrouded in mystery. Haitian police have arrested more than three dozen suspects, including 18 Colombian mercenaries, an obscure Haitian-American doctor they say aspired to be president, and the head of Moise's security team. But they have made public little in the way of evidence, and one judge investigating the case has stepped down, citing security concerns. The former First Lady says she's losing faith in the process and hopes the FBI will be able to help.
I'm asking myself, will they ever find the people that really have to be found? Because those people, they did it, but someone gave the orders, someone paid the money.
Haiti is now reeling from another crisis, a devastating earthquake that struck last month, killing at least 2,000 people. Elections initially slated for September have been postponed until November, and some have speculated they could be delayed further. Martine Moise called on the Prime Minister to hold the vote as soon as possible to ensure stability. She also confirmed to Reuters her previous comments about wanting a political career herself. She said she would not let her husband's vision die with him.
Flora Bradley Watson reports for Reuters News. And finally, Ukraine's parliament passed the country's Act of Declaration of Independence of Ukraine on August 24, 1991. The U.S. recognized the country's independence on December 25th of that same year, as well as opening an embassy in Kyiv. Now, since then, 9 ambassadors have represented the U.S. in Ukraine. Anna Rice narrates this look back at the last 3 decades of U.S.-Ukrainian relationships, as its president is scheduled to visit the White House on Wednesday.
Late 1990s, Ukraine is going through tough times. The constitution was adopted only recently. The country's economy is in stagnation. Stephen Pfeiffer was the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine from 1998 to 2000.
At the time, President Kuchma talked about a multi-vector policy, which looked at engaging with the United States, with Europe, and also with Russia. And remember, the 1990s, it was a very different Russia. You did not have Vladimir Putin as president. You had Boris Yeltsin. Mr. Yeltsin had many flaws, but he was consistent, for example, in supporting and recognizing Ukraine's territorial integrity, its sovereignty, and its independence.
Pfeiffer believes it was back in the 1990s that the Ukrainian people recognized the importance of having their own voice, something that would be seen vividly later during the Orange Revolution and the 2014 Dignity Revolution. President Bill Clinton, for one, visited Kyiv 3 times, in 1994, 1995, and 2000. However, in the early 2000s, the situation changed, recalls former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine John Herbst, who arrived in Kyiv in 2003.
U.S.-Ukraine relations were, generally speaking, positive and warm from independence until the late 90s, when concerns about corruption in Ukraine began to cloud the relationship.
During the Orange Revolution of 2004, the Ukrainian people protested presidential elections that international observers reported were rigged in favor of incumbent president Viktor Yanukovych.
My job from that point forward was to prevent a crackdown on the demonstrators in the streets and to help ensure that Yanukovych would not be declared president on the basis of a falsified or stolen election. And we know that a serious effort was made to arrange a crackdown on the demonstrators. Most of the government at that time, which again was the government of which Yanukovych was part, behaved with honor and in the right way.
After the Orange Revolution, the West was impressed with the level of democracy and peace seen in Ukraine, says former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine William Taylor.
I arrived as President Yushchenko and Prime Minister Tymoshenko were trying to work together. It was a challenge for both of them. It was an interesting time.
The 3 former U.S. ambassadors to Ukraine agree the country should be proud of how far it's come.
I remember making the comment when I was leaving Ukraine back in 2000, which is, I think 30 years from now, maybe it's a little bit optimistic, but 30 to 35 years now, I think Ukraine will be a successful story.
You had a vibrant people, very hospitable, fun-loving. And I was working in Kyiv, a beautiful city then and now. You had a government which was perhaps more authoritarian than democratic at the time. I would say now it's more democratic than authoritarian, but still elements of both then and now. You had an active civil society then and now, although civil society is obviously stronger today.
They had really pulled together, and there was this strong Ukrainian feeling that you could feel. So that was one of the highlights.
As Ukraine continues to consolidate its independence, the country's role in international affairs is projected to grow. For Maria Prus in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And this has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events. You can do so 24 hours a day. Just visit our website. You know the address. It's voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.